Good morning, I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show. Larry will be back tomorrow starting at 11. Let us begin this conversation with a quote from Thomas Eisner, who said, "Bugs are not going to inherit the earth, they own it now, so we might as well make peace with the landlord." It is with that in mind that we bring in our next guest for the next hour. Entomologist Phil Pelletier is back with us to talk about insects and answer your bug questions. Phil is a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. He retired as the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab back in 2014. And he's here to help with our landlords, our bugs. Give us your insect questions for Phil at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. If you've got a photo that you'd like ID'd of a bug that you found, you can also send that to our email address, talk@wpr.org, and we'll get Phil to get a look at it. And Phil, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show. I want to start today with just how quickly the bugs have come back this spring, because I'm always amazed that animals, any animals, or the bug kingdom makes it through Wisconsin winters. What are they doing all winter long, and how is it that they're so quick to bounce back each and every spring, Phil?
Yeah, it depends really which critter you talk about. We have some things that migrate up here. We have some things that overwinter as eggs, and they need to hatch and develop. So usually don't start seeing them until a little bit later. We have some that overwinter as adults. They usually find protected sites, but the dynamic with insects is they've got mechanisms where their body can freeze and they can survive. And, you know, it's just always been fascinating. And the other issue that I witnessed in my career is really, the winters have not been as severe as they were. We find that insect survival generally is better. In fact, the other unique thing is a lot of things that were not here when I first started as an entomologist have moved up this way. And so one of my favorite lines on the show is, the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us. But there is that dynamic, is that there are dozens of species that were considered southern that are now in the state.
And would ticks be part of that story, Phil?
Well, the tick, there's one. The Lone Star tick is basically a Missouri tick, I thought, and that has been found to breed in the state. We used to get intercepts, but they weren't breeding. But within the last 15 years, we know. And that one is a concern because it's the one associated with the meat allergy.
Yeah.
In bites. So other ticks, you know, it's interesting. A lot of press, this is tick season, per se, although the thing to keep in mind is most of the ticks you see at this time of the year are what we call wood ticks, but are officially called the American dog tick. And they are kind of a May-June critter. But the deer tick, which is much more concerning because it has a much larger list of diseases, is season. If there's no snow on the ground, they can be out there. And honestly, you get as much, if not more, pressure in the fall of the year as you do in the spring.
Yeah, and just the anecdotal reports seem to be that folks feel like ticks are darn near everywhere in Wisconsin already this spring. They're finding them on their dogs, they're finding them on their clothes, they're finding them just by going outside.
Yeah, no, I mean, the wood tick you can find in your front yard in just about any place. They're not real common, but, you know, and the more you get into lawn grass and the like, the more you find. It's interesting because, running the lab, I used to get hot spots every year coming in. I have been crawling around the woods a bit and turkey hunting and other things, and I have not found a tick on me yet. So
oh, wow.
I don't know what blessing I've come under, but it's been good to see.
Rob Ferret, the co-host of Wisconsin Today, pointed out the Centers for Disease Control heat map of tick-borne diseases, and you can see it pretty prominent out east through Pennsylvania, New York State, Vermont, New Hampshire, and of course Maine. But then it feels like there is not a lot through Ohio, Indiana, or Illinois, but there is a huge hot spot, according to the CDC, when it comes to the state of Wisconsin and a little bit west as you move over to Minnesota. Is there a reason that Wisconsin is a hotbed, according to the CDC, of tick-borne diseases, as you see it, Phil?
Yeah, it's basically all the deer tick. We officially call it the black-legged tick.
Mm.
And that has, as I said, a number of things: Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, tuberculosis. And, you know, our first records of that in the state were in the late 60s up in Spooner, where one of the graduate students was doing a research survey on ticks on mice and found it, and he published, because that was normally considered a southern tick. So they were not here in any numbers at that time, but we have seen them explode. And so that northwest part of the state was the focal point. It took them a few years to get through, so we had records throughout the state, but they've now spilled into northern Illinois, parts of Iowa. But when you start getting towards Ohio and whatnot, those ticks are really still very infrequent. But if you get in the East Coast, Lyme, Connecticut, that's the start of all of this. So it is a relatively recent development in the history of critters. And we're talking, again, the last 50 years or so.
And then part of that story would have to be our change in climate, wouldn't it?
Well, that definitely doesn't hurt their survival. Mm-hmm. It turns out the deer tick is probably more sensitive to moisture levels. The only time I think I ever saw a significant drop in populations, we had a really bad drought in 88 and into 89. And it took them, because they have a long life cycle, it takes them 2 years to go through a life cycle, it took them some time to recover. But I have yet to see, if we got a 30 below, that won't faze them. They're down in a place where it's not that cold. And as they said, they have the capacity to survive that stuff if they can prepare. It's always a condition. If you start with something that's at 60 degrees and throw it in the freezer, it dies quite quickly.
Sure.
But if you let it cool down very, very slowly and normally, then they can acclimate much easier.
That to me just sounds like a miracle of nature when you say they can get down to 30 below and it won't faze them. How is that possible? It's the miracle of survival that we find in the smallest creatures among us. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, entomologist, here to answer your bug questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Kathy in Wisconsin Rapids this morning. Kathy, hello.
Oh, I hope you can help me. I am just inundated with, I believe, gnats inside my house. I have tried everything I have found online, what I read. I don't know what more to do. And if you'd like me to tell you what I've tried, fine. Or if you
have... Yeah, no, I'd be curious what you've given a shot at so far.
Okay. I used vinegar and then put a little drop of soap in it because they said that would do it. Well, a few of them go in, but not near what I have. I have tried having someone come over and spray. They sprayed the outside and the inside in the basement because they're down there too with Home Defense. I've had that done twice now. I've washed the basement floor with bleach after I've, thought I've eradicated them. I check every day, and of course, they're mostly coming in on, I think, in my windows. And I have some newer windows, some older windows, and they are supposed to have a good seal, so I don't know. They're so tiny, hard to see how they get in. I don't know. But I find some dead ones now, from this spray, but they're still there. And then they seem, of course, to be lots of them by the kitchen sink and in the bathroom, I suppose, because of the water. Now I've noticed they must be becoming adults because they're getting wings.
Oh. So was this something that came up? I'm sorry, Kathy, is this something that came up this spring, or is this something you've been dealing with all winter?
Dealing with it. I just didn't think anything of it because, I had a few and I thought it was fruit flies. You know how
sure.
that happens.
Yeah.
So I didn't leave any of my fruit all out in garbage or anything, and that usually takes care of it. Well, little by little, you'd see a few, and I still, just would, squish them or whatever and didn't think anything of it. So this has been going on for a very long time. Mm. And now, of course, there's so many that you can't, I don't see them actually a lot flying around at me or in my house, but, they're there. They're on the windows, they're in the sink, they're in the toilet even. they're just awful.
Kathy, I appreciate it. Yeah,
did
Phil, go ahead.
Did the pest control service tell you what they thought the critters were?
He told me he thought it was gnats when I thought it was fruit flies. Because he said, and I couldn't tell. I actually took a magnifying glass. But he said, the fruit flies have kind of a reddish eye in these dents, which would mean they were probably gnats. And they're so tiny, some of them. They're like a little, I don't even know how to say, speck of pepper.
Okay. Phil?
Okay, so in these kind of cases, from my perspective, I usually want to see the critter, whether a pitcher. My first thought, because you say they're so small, when I think of little small gnat, and gnat is a generic term, it's just a small fly to an entomologist. But when I think of little small flies, there are things called fungus gnats that often breed in houseplants. Do you have a lot of houseplants?
No, I do not. I have little, I have sunlight, but I have a lot of a porch, and then I have, I don't think I even have any, I don't have any live plants in the house right now. Sometimes I have a bouquet of flowers, you know, that you buy. But
yeah. No, that's not a problem. So in can you think, did you see this problem in January and February where you had gnats, even a few on the windows?
Oh, sure. It's all year.
Okay, yeah. So it's fine to call a pest control service in, but honestly, if they can't give you something more definitive than that, to me, it's kind of shooting in the dark. And from my perspective is if I know who it is, then I can point to the kind of source that we have to look at. And again, just the example, it doesn't sound like it's fungus gnats to you, but if you have fungus gnats, you can spray all you want. And if you don't treat them in the soil of your house plants, you still have fungus gnats. Hmm. So you know, if you can take a decent picture, you can send it to PJ, who is the person that has taken over the insect diagnostic lab at the university, or you can mail him a sample. But I think I would hesitate doing anything more until we get a more definitive line at what's going on. You know, there are critters that come in the fall, but they shut down all winter long. And I said in your comments, the thing about any winged insect is an adult, and no, it doesn't grow anymore. There are such things as wingless adult insects, but when you talk about real tiny things, you know, I'm worrying about springtails and mites and, I mean, all kinds of critters. And so I really think we need to get a definitive answer who you got, and then I think we can give you a better idea. But I don't see spraying right now as a solution because we don't know where the fire is kind of the way to put it.
So right now it's like you're just shooting at smoke if you're just going to spray.
And yeah. As I said, the term gnat is, I mean, fruit flies can be very frustrating because, you know, you think about they fly around your bananas, but they're not breeding there. They're breeding in decaying vegetable matter. And it could be a pumpkin down in the basement or, you know, all kinds of crazy things. But that's another classic example. You can put vinegar out and catch a few, but if you don't get to the source, you still got fruit flies.
Yeah, and I've had that experience, but I've also used the vinegar and soap method to some effect in the past. But when you talk about just spraying for insects, are these sprays targeted, or do they tend to affect a large swath of any sort of bug?
Yeah, they tend to be rather broad spectrum, but it's how you use them.
Okay.
And, you know, for so many of the nuisance problems you get in the house, you talk about elder bugs and all these other things, spraying in the house doesn't get you anywhere because they've already gotten your walls and the like. And so, you know, for these fall invaders, you can spray outside and you're spraying along the foundation and maybe the overhangs. So kind of selected places. So it's not like you're spraying everywhere in the yard because that's not going to get you anywhere. It's targeting these kind of openings so that they can get through. And generally speaking, many of these sprays are almost more repellent than they are killing power. When they're wet, they kill, but when they're not, they have some repellency to them. So, you know, if they stop coming in the house, you're happy whether you killed them or you drove them off. But timing is everything. Different critters come in at different times, and you got to make sure that you're there at the right time. And as I said, in the house, more often than not, the vacuum cleaner is probably my better direction to go because it's, you're not getting at the source of things. You just got something in front of you and you clean them up with the vacuum cleaner and go from there.
So don't spray, perhaps suck, Kathy, might be the best steps, but also getting a hold of PJ Leash, who is now leading the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, where you can send pictures or you can also send a sample if you can catch a few, and they will analyze it for you and let you know exactly what it is, as the gnat may just be a generic term for whatever is infesting your house. And I really appreciate the call, and I hope you get some solutions, and please follow up with us and let us know. Phil Pelletieri is our guest. He's the former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, and an entomologist here to answer your questions today and ID your bugs if you'd like to send us some pictures to talk@wpr.org. Otherwise, you can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Phil Pelletieri back with us today, entomologist here to answer your bug and insect questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, who returns tomorrow after another exciting night last night at the Widener Center in Green Bay. For more of Larry Mueller's upcoming appearances, you can check out the website WPR.org/presents. He'll be at Bayfield in Bloom May 29th for live garden talk and at the Barrymore Theater in Madison Wednesday, June 3rd. We ask you to register. Tickets are free online at WPR.org/presents. Have an email here from Phil. From Mike, who emailed us, Phil. He says he believes he may have some of these fungus flies that you're talking about. How do you go about eradicating them?
Okay, so this one gets a little tricky. They're not so hard to kill, but the treatment can be more severe on your plants than the critters ever could. Mm. They're breeding on organic matter that's in the soil. And the trouble with some insecticides is some of the carriers that you put on will cause root pruning and other problems, phytotoxic problems to the plant. But there is an organic solution. It takes a little chasing around, but it turns out to be a bacterial insecticide. And there are different strains of this. There's stuff you can put on your broccoli to kill the little green worms, but this happens to be a strain that is made for killing maggots, and these are technically maggots. So you can get some of these. Usually you might have to order, or if you go to a larger garden center, they should have it. And you just sprinkle it in the soil, and when the larvae feed on it, they die. But interesting enough, pets, kids, and whatnot are not affected at all.
So that's good.
Selective way of doing it. Again, it's going after the source. If you only had a couple plants and they weren't important, probably an easier solution is just get rid of the plants. The other thing to keep in mind is what kind of potting mix you've got, because there are some potting mixes that do not have the kind of organic matter that support fungus gnats. So that is something to consider. But it can be a little bit of a battle. But again, using the right stuff can take care of it. And you should see a dramatic drop within about a week or so of using them, because the adults are very short lived. The adults, as the people talk about seeing them at windowsills and other things kind of piling up, but, that's not normal. And if you've got lots of little gnats in the house, as I said, that is definitely one of the main possibilities.
So what should Mike ask his garden center for here?
Well, I know the product is BTI.
DTI.
Okay? BTI. It's
BTI.
Bacillus thuringiensis, and the strain is Israeliensis. But if he can ask just for a bacterial insecticide for treating houseplants. It really is the only one that's out there. They use forms of this for treating mosquitoes at times, too. It's a very interesting product.
Mike, thank you for the email. We'll go next to Dan in Manitowoc. Dan, good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I had a gnat problem for a long time, first in Florida, where I lived, and they diagnosed as drain flies. And then I looked at them under a microscope, and they didn't look like drain flies, but probably fungus gnats. And what we did many, many things, but the one thing that finally worked for us was we bought a bug zapper for inside the house. It was on, online, and it was $20-$30. And we noticed that there were a lot more of them around the kitchen sink and the bathroom sink. And so we put the bug zapper next to the sink, and every so often we'd hear a very satisfying snap and knew that another one had bitten the dust. And then they were in a little tray at the end of the day. And so that really worked for us. And this year, when I brought in my house plants, the plants outside, brought them in, there were, gnats coming out of that soil, and we just set the bug zapper next to it. And yeah, the moms and dads didn't get together, and so we exterminated them all.
Yeah, well, definitely many insects are attracted to UV light, and bug zappers have their place. But, what you had mentioned, the underlying aspect from my side of why you need to know who it is, there is a critter that I call a sewer fly. There is another critter I call a drain fly. And they breed on the accumulated debris that's in your sink, and you can wash and put hot water down it, and that gunk does not go away. And it's like a slime, and that's where the maggots come from. And they can be very frustrating because you don't know. It could be a basement floor drain, which often doesn't get enough water to flush it anyway. Once you know the source, you can try a good hot water. Bleach's not so good because all you're doing is sterilizing the outside of the pipe, and you're really not cutting through it. In industrial settings and food plants, they have this problem quite commonly. And honestly, there are special materials. You can use a drain cleaner, but there are also special bacterial mixes that they put in that digest all that gunk in the sewer. And if there's no gunk there, there's no critters.
Well, that sounds like a solution. And again, when you're talking about these bug zappers, I guess I'd never thought of one indoors. But Phil, what's your take on bug zappers outside? Because I know once mosquito season hits, a lot of backyards will be using them to try to keep the bites at bay.
Well, the problem with zappers, as the listener had mentioned, you hear it zap and you get this kind of revenge feeling. But when you talk about outside, it turns out such a small percentage of what you catch are mosquitoes, and you're catching lots of other incidental critters and some that we would definitely define as beneficial because they help us control some of the pests. So it really is, maybe you can make the argument almost as broad spectrum as some insecticides as far as killing everything anything that's attracted to light. So I'm not a big fan. We use them in certain ways of sampling what kind of mosquitoes are in an area. And they're designed in a special way for that. They're not near the big zappers that you think about. And half the time when you hear stuff zapping, it's a moth or
right.
Like I said, some miscellaneous critter. Now indoors, it's a little more selective because again, you've got a limited number of critters that are around, and if they are attracted to UV light, then that will go. And I see on TV all kinds of interesting, maybe not even zappers. Some of them have little sticky trays. Same idea. They attract it to the light. They get caught on the sticky tray, and then you just replace the tray every once in a while. Especially in restaurants, it's a little more common because the problem with a zapper in a restaurant is you're pulverizing this thing into air, and if there's germs and whatnot, that's not good. Whereas if you've got a sticky card, then you keep the thing confined, and you can it's more sanitary.
Helen in Oregon called but couldn't stay with us. She said she puts covers on her drains to prevent those gnats.
Yes, I mean, that would be fine, although, again, when things flood, make sure that the water can get down. Sometimes doing that is a way of verifying to yourself. So if you can put a cover on the drain
sure.
So it can't come out and all of a sudden the critters come, then you know the problem's in the drain and then you can start looking at what kind of solutions you might have and the like. And it's interesting. I find more in the fall and early winter, we get a few what I call drain flies. And they're little fuzzy things, but they're technically flies. They look like moths, little tiny things. And again, what it is just that accumulation of debris that rings inside the bathroom sink. And, toothpaste and all the stuff you're putting down there,
yes.
Things do accumulate. And as I said, if it's got the right organic matter, these little devils will take advantage of it.
Drain flies, sewer flies. Oh, my. Let's go to Renee in Madison next. Renee, good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm calling about some things we bought called mosquito dunks, and you put them in water to kill the larvae of mosquitoes for up to 30 days. It says they're safe for fish habitats and bird baths and rain barrels and water troughs, and yet it says keep out of reach of children. So I'm wondering about those. Are they effective and are they safe?
They are effective, and I wonder just with labeling rules, they have to put that on there. This is basically a different form of what we were talking about as a solution for the gnats in houseplants. It's the same bacteria. My personal opinion is if you had a fish pond or something similar, they're great. A bird bath, you could probably do as good. If you dumped a bird bath once a week,
okay.
And put new water in it, that would be a solution without having to go to the dunks. It just depends kind of on a convenience thing. One of the problems with the dunks in a bird bath is if it really rains a lot, it gets all washed out. You got to reapply it anyway. They're very selective. As I said, the interesting thing, they don't affect the birds. They don't affect the bees, but they affect the, quote, maggot or the larvae of the mosquito when it eats it, and that's what kills it. Doesn't affect adult mosquitoes. But in fish ponds and whatnot, where, it's really hard to treat something like that. They're very good. And you could use the frogs, the fish, everybody else is fine, but mosquitoes, not so much.
Do you have any forecast for our mosquito season? And Phil, I'd be curious to know what kind of factors affect how intense our mosquito season can be.
So from an entomologist standpoint, there are over 50 species. So I can tell you a whole bunch of stories, but there are two big waves typically. up in the northern half of the state in particular, the group come from what we call snowmelt mosquitoes. They are associated with the ponds that you see in the spring out in the woods from lots of snow. And so how much snow you have can influence those. And they start coming out just about now. They're out for about a month, and there's only one cycle of them, and you're done.
Oh.
The cursed mosquitoes in the state are from ones that we call summer floodwater mosquitoes. And these things exist as eggs out in nature. And when they flood, and it can be 3 years after they lay, so they're kind of like little time bombs, they hatch. And it will, depending on temperature, take 2 to 3 weeks to get the adults off. That wave is coming. Now, you know, it was so wet earlier, I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be something. But it's dried off enough now that they're still coming. And typically, you expect the rush to come somewhere within a week of Memorial Day. If it's a very warm spring, the early. If they're a cold spring, it might be a few days late. So it's always when you go camping for the first time, it's the risk that it's going to happen. And the other thing that curses us with that mosquito is if it floods again a month from now and those new eggs hatch or get flooded, they can hatch again. So you can get multiple waves of them.
Wow.
And then the other thing is that it is not unusual for them to travel 10 to 15 miles from their breeding site. So although we talk about bird baths and other things that are a potential habitat for mosquitoes, most of the time when you get mosquitoes in your backyard, they're blowing in from down the road. You know, and I can point at Spring Green as being a source around the river of mosquitoes that come into Madison in certain years. And that's what makes it so frustrating to deal with is you really can't get to the source very easily. And as I said, so I don't know. As I said, I'm backing off a little bit, but normal mosquitoes are not fun. You know, and so as I said, I expect it to pick up within the next 10 days to 2 weeks. And then what happens for the rest of the year is more on rainfall patterns. And you need to hold water for about 2 weeks to breed mosquitoes. And, you know, with these floodwater ones, they're breeding in the darn ditches next to the highway.
Sure.
You know, flood type of thing. And so there's lots of these temporary habitats. The argument in a pond is it's a more stable environment. It's got fish. It's got other insects in there that eat mosquitoes. Lakes, you know, rivers, there's no mosquitoes I know that breed in moving water. You know, and it's more these temporary things. And that's why technically the bird bath. Now, why that gets so much interest is it turns out the mosquito that breeds in those kind of containers is one of the ones that is most notorious for spreading human disease.
Mm.
So, you know, if you're worrying about human disease, you don't want bird baths and other, even flooded tires. You know, you got discarded tires, the water accumulates in there. That's a great habitat for breeding these darn container mosquitoes. And as I said, the concern is that with encephalitis and other things, those are more important than the floodwater ones that I talked about.
What does an entomologist use to avoid mosquito bites? What's the best bet from your perspective, Phil?
Well, you know, you look at the stuff. To be honest, when I've got two things that I use. I belong to an archery club that's in the middle of a swamp. And so in the summer, it is when the mosquitoes are bad, it's hard to shoot arrows unless I have insecticide-treated clothing that you can get at L.L. Bean or REI or whatnot. It contains the insecticide permethrin, but this was a technology that the Army developed up in Camp McCoy way back in the 60s and 70s. That you can put this on, and it really repels more than kills, but it stops the mosquitoes. And then when things really get out of hand, to be honest, I have a head net. I just don't, you know, I think we've all gotten that situation that no matter what you try, you need something really heavy duty, or it's not going to be possible. And as I said, that's kind of the backup. Now, as far as my home lawn, it really isn't bad. If things are really, you know, really intense, I stay in the screen porch, or we will set up a fan on the front porch to blow the air to keep them away. But as far as treating my lawn, I really don't see any benefit to that, except if, you know, you're having your daughter's wedding in the backyard and you had a bunch of guests coming and whatnot, and it's the middle of June. I think it's reasonable to consider having a commercial treatment done if the mosquitoes are bad 3 or 4 days beforehand. But to have this done every month, you're killing a whole bunch of stuff that isn't there. And some years are dry and some years are wet. I'm not a big fan of preventatively treating mosquitoes, but sometimes you can see the train coming. And as I said, and given the situation, it's reasonable to do those treatments if you understand that you're getting you know, 5-6 days of relief out of it. And the thing that we do not do in this state, and it's because we historically have not had a lot of mosquito-borne diseases. In many states, they have mosquito abatement districts. And what they do is they go out and identify the main breeding sites. These are usually multi-county, because mosquitoes travel so much, areas, and they will go treat them. Now, you know, we have had some treatments in the Madison area, and I know other places, where we have been treating specific mosquitoes that can spread human disease, you know, in catch basins and the like. But as far as having a community-wide abatement district, that just isn't done here typically. Whereas even in Illinois and some of the states close to us, again, more because of historic reasons, they have at least some mechanism of trying to reduce the populations by getting after the breeding site.
Is there a ripple effect in reducing those mosquito populations? I mean, I'd imagine that there are some birds and bats that would rely on these for feed.
Yeah, although, you know, I've often pondered, if all the mosquitoes went away, there's enough other gnats and things to keep the birds and bats happy.
Okay.
It's one of those things when you're asked the philosophical question, what good are mosquitoes? Well, again, you can say it, but they often will report bats, the thousands of mosquitoes they eat. And if that's all they ate, and you talked about how much food they've got in their tummy, yeah, that would be it. But it turns out they're eating a lot bigger things. They're much more efficient at getting food, and they don't eat as many mosquitoes as some people might think. Things like dragonflies and whatnot probably do a better job of controlling adult mosquitoes than birds and bats. They don't hurt, but as I said, you can overstate, because they're feeding on so many other flying insects, and mosquitoes are small enough in the like that they really don't waste their time that much going after them.
Let's go to Jan in Madison next. Jan, good morning. You're on the air with Phil Pelletieri.
Well, good morning. I'm noticing and hearing you talk about mosquitoes in ponds and water, you know, water sources and things like that. I'm wondering what your opinion is about the mosquito business people that spray everything in the world around your house in order to kill the mosquitoes, which really doesn't kill the mosquitoes.
Well, I feel like I've seen some billboards for these businesses last summer in Madison.
They have picked up. They have definitely picked up in the last 5 to 6 years. And as I said, what I was stating earlier is there are certain circumstances, if you're having a big family get together in your backyard and the mosquitoes are bad, the chemical they put down, you know, they're spraying the shrubbery and the like, and anything that lands on that in the next few days is going to die. And mosquitoes are tricky because they blow into an area and they lay low, and then their activity patterns pick up at dawn and dusk when the wind speeds are low and the lights go down. That's honestly when they come out. If the wind's like today blowing 15 miles an hour, they're not going to get you. They're not dumb enough to get up in the air because they're not strong enough flyers. So as I said, there are circumstances. Now, I cannot justify in Wisconsin in the average year spraying my lawn 4 times for mosquitoes. It just, as I said, and I can argue that there are things like spider mites on your plants and other things that are shown to cause you more problems when you spray like that because you upset the balance. You're taking a whole bunch of other things out that are really beneficial to have around. So, as I said, I understand the concept. I understand certain circumstances, but I'm not a fan of, you know, hiring a company to come in. In some years that you hire them, you know, you sign the contract in the spring and it never rains and there's no mosquitoes anyway. So what do you get out of that?
Last summer, I've got an open porch, and last summer we put, and we'd get a lot of ankle bites from mosquitoes. It's a raised porch a little bit, but we put a fan on the porch last year and found very few ankle biting mosquitoes for our summer outdoor activities. So I found a fan to be a pretty natural mosquito repellent, Phil.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Again, it goes back to this point. They are not strong flyers.
Right.
And so if you can get a good airspeed going, and they can't get to you. And you know, it's somewhat limited, but if you've got the right circumstance, it's a great solution. Now, you know, one of the other things that, I'm foolish enough to sit in a tree trying to hunt deer sometimes. And if the mosquitoes are bad early, usually it settles down. But the other thing that I use is a product. The commercial name, the one I use, is Thermacell. There are other devices, but basically it has a little bit of liquid gas that heats a coil. And on that coil, they put a a piece of fabric that is treated with insecticide, and what it generates is a little bit of a smoke. And honestly, it really does is quite efficient having the smoke around it. They're using synthetic pyrethroids, usually permethrin or something similar, as the active ingredient. And they do even sell smaller devices for putting on your picnic table. And the same thing. But one of the problems, again, depends which way the wind's going and whatnot, because
sure.
this is like a little bit of a fog. And as I said, it helps in some circumstances, but it isn't a solution in itself. But it is some situations another viable thing to think about. You know, you're out in a picnic at a state park or something. What are you going to do? Well, if you have one of these devices, you can at least keep things down.
Would you call it a thermocell?
Well, thermocell is the commercial name of the one I've probably seen, the most common product. They're both is a device, a personal device for putting on your belt.
Oh.
And there are bigger devices, as I said, for putting on picnic tables and the things outside. And they said it will have a little thing, canister of gas, which you might have to replace every once in a while. And the pads that you put on there, some last for 2 hours, some last for 4 hours, whatever. And usually they change color, and then you know that it's time to put a new pad in.
The mosquitoes are coming. The mosquitoes are coming. That's from Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. He retired as the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab back in 2014, taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. And we have to talk about ants when we come back. So, Teresa, I hope you can stick around. That will be when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Well, let's see. We've talked about ticks. We've talked about fungus gnats, drain flies, sewer flies, mosquitoes. I suppose we have yet to get to the ants with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist and distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. So for that, we'll go to Teresa in Albany next. Teresa, good morning.
Good morning. So I've had ants coming into my house since I bought it 2 years ago. And we tried, you know, keeping everything clean and tried sealing any cracks we could find. But they just kept finding more cracks to come through because it was an old house.
Mm-hmm.
So despite what we wanted, we went with a service that would come by and spray. And that's kept the ants out, but I'm concerned for the local wildlife. Just this morning, I found two of our beloved local squirrels dead at the foot of their tree.
Oh, no.
And we've watched them through the window since the babies were born, and it's just really heartbreaking. And so I'm trying to think, what can we do to keep these ants out without harming other wildlife?
I'm so glad you called. Phil,
sure.
Go ahead.
Did you watch the people when they sprayed the house?
So most of what I saw them do was they had like this brush thing that they just sort of like brushed around the windows and stuff. I didn't actually see them.
Okay, no, that's what I was looking for. Yeah. So, you know, the game with ants, it gets real complicated because there's numerous different kinds. But the bottom line is most of them are outdoor ants. They're coming in for food. And, you know, you did what we would like. You know, if you figure out what they're squeezing through and get it sealed, they stop coming in. But as you said, that can be very difficult. I'm guessing that, and you should have, if they left you a receipt, what chemical they used. But what has changed in my career, in fact, the last 20 years in particular for ant control, there's a product called fipronil. Fipronil, honestly, we put on dogs and cats as frontline, among other things. And so it seems to be relatively under the right circumstances. I mean, some cats don't do the best with it, and so I'm not saying it's not without some issues. But if you apply that right at the base of the foundation and around windows, once it dries, nothing else is affected. So I'm impressed. Now, if he sprayed something else and they were spraying all over, could squirrels be involved? Possible, but that's still a bit of a long shot.
Okay.
The real toxic chemicals that we were using 30 and 40 years ago for pest control around the house are not available. You know, they were broad spectrum. They were straight nerve poisons that could even affect people if you were careless. You know, they said things have gotten to a point now that there are products, both how you use them by being selective in getting those, they said, along the base of the house and along the window frames where they can sneak in. And what you choose, you should not have is near the non-target kind of problems that we used to have. Now, the squirrels, you know, boy, it's hard to say what was involved there. That's scary. You know, is some disease that the squirrels are picking up? That's hard to say, you know, without getting a wildlife person involved in with it. But as I said, I think the other thing about fipronil is that typically one treatment takes you a whole year. So the whole idea that you need to have a pest control service come in on a very regular basis, you know, it used to be monthly. Maybe if you live in Florida, but not in Wisconsin and the like. And so, as I said, I'm a proponent of, you know, being very selective, you know, target the critter, target what you're using. And I think you're much less likely to have non-target impacts.
How do you spell that, Phil?
Fipronil is the active ingredient. It's F-I-R-P-R-O-N-I-L. It is a product that typically is applied. There are some baits that use it. It is a product that is probably going to be hard to find as a homeowner unless you can go to do your own pest control. There are various companies on the internet. This is a product that is marketed to pest control services, but is not typically marketed to homeowners, not because of toxicity, just because of marketing decisions. And as I said, the interesting thing is that in different forms, it's put on pets for fleas and ticks and the like. So, you know, you could possibly even do it yourself if you want to go through with that. I really have been amazed. Sometimes if I put it on once every 3 years, all I seem to have to do. Now, the other way of fighting ants is to bait them.
Yeah.
You know, either ants have a sweet tooth or they feed on protein and fats. Now, there is a very common ant material that you can get called taro, T-E-R-R-O. It's boric acid and sugar. So if it's a sweet-feeding ant, you put it out, they pick it up, and they take it back and feed each other. And honestly, I found it to really be quite effective if they are sweet-feeding ants. If they are not sweet-feeding ants, they ignore it. But you can mix a little cooking oil or whatnot and get the same effect. Now, the whole idea about controlling ants is to find the nest and treat it directly. But if it's under a rock somewhere, that's not so easy to do. If you see the ant nest, there's one way of, you know, going after that. But as I said, most of the ants that are coming in our house are after food. So the idea of cleaning up is a good idea. But I'm not so sure anybody can keep the house so clean that ants don't come in. And as I said, then to me, the line of defense is along the outside the house where we both get repellency and kill. What makes fipronil unique, it's not repellency. The ants don't know it's there. They pick it up. And literally, they transfer it to other ants, which is absolutely fascinating to me, how it does it on contact. And so when they've used it for carpenter ants, they have found that you can kill a carpenter ant colony that's in a tree 40 yards from the house by just doing this perimeter treatment along the base of the house, which to me is great. But it's also fascinating because it's not what I normally expect insecticides to perform that way.
Phil, we got an email from Evelyn in Appleton who wants to talk about viburnum beetles. She said, last year you said to remove viburnum bushes because of the beetles and not to plant any more of them. Is that still the case this year?
It depends on the kind of viburnum. I've got some Korean spice viburnum. And although viburnum leaf beetle has moved into Madison in the last 3 or 4 years, I never see it. But when I'm out going for my walk, the high bush cranberry, 2 blocks away, gets hit. So I think you can do a search on the internet about viburnums that are resistant to leaf beetle. It's still a viable plant. But if you have a susceptible plant, then you've got to figure you're going to have a battle every spring or remove the plant and put something that is lower maintenance.
Diane called but couldn't stay with us. She's wondering if there are good ways to get rid of jumping worms.
Oh, boy.
That sounds like a no.
Yeah, well, okay, a couple things. You know, I don't know of any insecticide that is officially registered as a worm-killing agent. Any product, anyway. There are some things that do it on the side, part of it, but you know, we can't get into that because that's using it off label. Mm. So no, unfortunately. Now, with that being said, back when I was a kid, you used to be able to buy this mustard, powdered mustard that you mix with water, you pour it on the soil, and the worms come out like, and we'd use it for fishing. Mm. It was a way of flushing them. I don't know where that stuff is anymore, if there's still some stuff out there. What's interesting to watch in my yard with jumping worms, you know, I heard about things going on. We were very careful with plants that we brought in and transplanting plants. You know, it was almost like you turned a light on. They were everywhere in the neighborhood all of a sudden. And typically, my experience with invasives like this is the first year they get here, and for the first few years, they are the most problematic, but things settle down. And that's kind of where we've been. My wife and I have disagreements sometimes about if we've got plants that are really suffering from them. My general take is not. But I know in a wooded situation and whatnot, environmentally, they're doing a whole bunch of things that are not good. You know, you talk about spring ephemerals in the woods and whatnot. It's changing the environment. And what's so fascinating is none of the worms we have here are really native. I mean, all this stuff has come reintroduced since the Ice Age and the like. And sometimes we say nice things about worms, but generally when you get out into a, you know, a natural wooded situation, worms are not good of any sort. And just, again, because they are upsetting normal balance. And what jumping worms take that to a new degree is because of the way they feed on organic matter and the like, you know, they do make it tough on plants. And when they first got here, there were times that my mulch looked like coffee grounds, which is, you know, kind of typical of, sure, of all that stuff they've digested. But I will tell you, it's gotten much better in the last 4 or 5 years. So I'm kind of knocking on wood that things have settled down. But boy, as I said, I mean, if you think of it, if you had something that killed worms that easy, it would kill lots of other things, and that's going to be very difficult to get registered.
So with a few minutes we have left here, let's get to Mark in Timberlake quick. Mark, good morning.
Hello, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
I live in downtown Kimberly, and my apartment, you know, doesn't have screens on it, the windows, and to me, there's an insect crisis going on because, like 3 years ago, I would have insects fly in. In 7 years, I haven't seen a mosquito here. I get this pond across the street in a park, and there were spring peepers until 3 years ago, and they've gone away. And there were two dueling bullfrogs in the pond that sounded off all the time, and that was great. But and there was even a migration of frogs out of the pond, and they'd come up hundreds of yards out, little inch in diameter frogs.
So we're talking about the observation of insect population decline, and I'm sorry we're short on time, Mark, but I want to give Phil a time to address this. Are those observations accurate as you see them, and is this a concern for you, Phil?
Yes.
Yes.
For as long as when I was a kid, you'd go by a street light, and I know there are different kinds of lights that attract insects, but there were things fluttering around all the time. I don't see that anymore, and haven't for quite some time. And, you know, it has been documented overall the insect population declines, which affect bird populations and other things. And, yes, it is concerning. And there's a number of reasons, but, you know, it can't be good is kind of the way I've faced it. And even though, you know, a lot of people have a hard time warming up to insects, we know that there's a lot of good stuff that they do for us, so.
Yeah, there's another quote here from E.O. Wilson, biologist. If all mankind were to disappear, the world would regenerate back to the rich state of equilibrium that existed tens of thousands of years ago. But if insects were to vanish, the environment would collapse into chaos. With that in mind, Phil, thank you as always for your wisdom. Looking forward to catching up with you again on the Larry Mueller Show. Thank you, sir.
Yes, take care.
Entomologist, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at UW-Madison, and the former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, Phil Pelletieri. When we continue, what can young farmers do to find farmland to till and grow and feed? That's the story after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.